The following is a Mediocre Movie Club production.
Welcome back to the Mediocre Movie Club podcast. I'm John Kissel, and with me tonight is Sean Riley.
Hello.
J.R. Peters.
Howdy.
And Joe Settner.
Hey.
We are doing our seventh entry in our What Have You Been Watching series tonight. We haven't done one of these in a long time, and specifically, we really wanted to talk about one thing in particular that we're going to save until the very end. But in the meantime, Joe, what have you been watching?
So I had the entire summer off because I'm a teacher and I actually go back tomorrow. So I spent a good amount of the summer binging on The Office and Parks and Rec. I'd never seen either one before, so I kind of wanted to get in on the jokes.
Which one do you give the edge to?
I was thinking about this all this week because I just finished Parks and Rec. And I think my favorite character is in Parks and Rec, but it's The Office. It's a better show, for sure.
Did you get all the way through The Office?
Yes. Yes, I did.
And even with those last three seasons, give or take, you would still give the lead to The Office?
Yeah, I mean, it's not like the last season and a half or two of Parks and Rec. I mean, they kind of jumped the shark themselves, but...
Yeah, and the first season of Parks and Rec is almost unbearable.
Yeah, it is. And
but it's so short. I mean,
seven episodes, maybe
six? Yeah, you got to get through like that whole Robert California season with The Office. And Andy, as like the star of the show, was like a terrible mistake on their part. They just never like figured that character out as the manager.
The Office certainly had a longer sustained peak, where Parks and Rec, between Ron Swanson and Chris Pratt's character and even Leslie Knope, may have individual parts that are fantastic, but I mean, the long peak of The Office outweighs, you know, its shitty downfall.
Yeah, I think I'm there with Sean on this. And I know everybody absolutely loves Ron Swanson, but he's not my favorite character by any means from The Office.
Rob Lowe has got to be the best character.
Dude, I loved Rob Lowe.
Whatever his character is there.
This is how great Parks and Rec is, that you could bust out a character who's there for like 60% of the series that... people would say he's their favorite character, sure, but there's like a top 10 list, and Rob Lowe is like in probably the bottom five of that. There's just a wealth of people to choose from.
Sure, but he's fantastic.
Everything about his character is great. I love it. He's just like so obsessed with his wealth, which is just completely different than everything everyone else is doing. Everyone else is like, yeah, we're going to go to this restaurant and eat 7,000 waffles. And he's like, yeah, I can't even walk into a hospital because it's going to ruin me. Yeah. It's going to kill me.
Waffles would literally kill me.
He's literally the most positive person, you know, positive character. And then this horrible, horrible town just slowly eats away at him. And it's really kind of a tribute to the show that the town is able to break him down.
We're getting into the weeds here a little bit in a podcast. We're going to discuss like a dozen different things in 45 minutes. But I would slightly quibble with that. Like, Pawnee's not a good place, but it's not a bad place either. And like, his sunny outlook was false, I think, after a certain point. It was like, because he needed to do all that therapy with Dr. Richard Nygaard. Like, that was important. Was that happy person who was totally satisfied and everything, then he wouldn't have needed to do it. I prefer Parks. It's just a different kind of humor. Like, that awkward stuff with The Office is really well done, but it's just not as fun. It's just not as fun as, like, the joyous buoyancy of Parks and Rec.
I'm with that exact same reasoning. I don't have a problem with a lot of the dry humor that happens in The Office, but... to a point.
JR, what have you been watching?
So for my first one, I'm going to go with Glow. For those of you that don't know, Glow is about the starting of this women's wrestling league. So season one came out last year, and it was probably one of the best shows I watched last year, top five for me at least. So the whole first season was about building up to the first, trying to get booked, basically. And then season two is they've been booked, and now they're, like, trying to flesh out these characters that they made, you know, figure out ways to not keep it stale. And I'm not sure I liked it as much as the first season. I don't know. Not stale, but it just felt kind of weird because I think I enjoyed the first season because it was always, like, everything was hectic because they didn't know, you know, going from episode to episode, they always have this, like, looming, like, we're going to get canceled. So we've got to do, you know, like, we might not make it there. Let's find out what this crazy stuff we might need to do. And then it's just more of like, okay, now we're all buddy-buddy. And a lot of the people hated each other in the first season, so they had that. Now they're all buddy-buddy, and they're happy about it. But then they also are dealing with the sort of fame they have. I don't know. I thought it was still a good season, but definitely not as good as the first one, in my opinion.
So I have not watched this show yet, but I feel like you're describing part of a problem that Netflix has had with a couple shows now. Like, I feel like you could have just described Orange is the New Black, where, you know, they get over the first problem and they're buddy-buddy, and the second season just completely falls off.
That was not necessarily my experience with Orange is the New Black. Like, I thought it was pretty solid all the way through. But as far as Glow is concerned, I do think that there is like some usual streaming channel bloat in Glow. Like, it's supposed to be a half hour comedy, and sometimes episodes go 40 minutes. Like in our best of so far, I talked about The End of the Fucking World on Netflix, which was a standard 22 minutes per episode, and that so there just wasn't that much time in that series to, like, go down dead ends. Like I kind of think that Glow does. Every show doesn't need to be an hour or 40 minutes or however long. Like, this is just a show looking about putting on a television show about female wrestlers. Like,
yeah,
keep it short and compact.
And they tried to have, like, episodes that were about specific people. Mm-hmm. And I felt that those episodes definitely fell flat. Like, it wasn't – every episode wasn't set up that way. Where, like, so what was it? What's her name? The black lady. What's her
– Cherry Bang?
Welfare Queen.
Welfare Queen. Yeah.
Well, I can't remember what her name is in the show.
They do a whole episode with her, and it didn't, I don't know, I didn't like the episode. So it felt like a whole, you know, fifth of the, or how many episodes, a whole tenth of the season was just like a waste.
You know, like, she was the champion. They've got 10 characters that have been in every single one of their episodes.
Yeah, I'm sure it's more than that. Oh, it sounds like you're looking at, like, Wikipedia.
Yeah, I'm looking at it. Okay. And it's 10 characters and another 4 or 5 that have been in 19 of the 20. That's a lot to carry.
Yeah. And I like those kind of ensemble shows, just because when something isn't working, you can always throw to someone else. And as the series goes on, you might find that a character or an actor is killing it in a way that you didn't expect them to. And then all of a sudden that they have more stuff in the show, deservedly. And just that kind of unpredictability, I think, is good for writers in that they just kind of see how stuff shakes out. I think I'm more positive on the second season than you guys were. I did also notice that it seemed like they were really leaning into a lot of, like, contemporary political issues. Like, there was an episode about sexual harassment, and there's, like,
the main
episode there about like, racism and racist depictions of minorities, and one of the characters... Well, I mean, some of these... It's not surprising, in like a roller derby sense, that some of these women are lesbians, but that felt a little more wooden than... the thing with the new wrestler and the wrestler who's, like, the Lebanese terrorist, that... that just kind of crept up as the season went on. And it does somewhat.
Are you take saying that's forced?
Beirut.
Yeah, Beirut. Not necessarily that it's forced. It just kind of feels like we need to do something with this character. What if we made her a lesbian?
No, it was definitely forced, and it didn't happen. I don't think it crept up. It was like episode 7, and
sure,
something happened.
They take their time because that character, neither of those characters,
they don't even
can hold down an episode
anything by
themselves.
Yeah, so they don't even do anything.
In, sure,
or like, but then it's like, oh, they look at each other, and they've like the first time you ever see them like talking to each other. You're like, yeah, they're gonna hook it up. Like, it's not even slight. I don't think it was like hidden at all. You just, as soon as they start talking, you're like, yeah, they're definitely hooking up by the end of the season.
Like, yeah, I think it's plot as character instead of like character leading into plot. Like the stuff with, again, I can't ever fucking remember character names on television shows that I watch in like 3 or 4 days. It just all goes by so fast. The hero wrestler, Liberty Bell, whatever her name is. Like, at a certain point, she starts doing coke and she loses her shit in the ring and she breaks Ruth's ankle or her leg or whatever. Like, that all makes sense because she's frustrated about her situation in life. Now she's being overlooked by the other producers. Great. That's all good stuff. But in contrast to the Beirut and Black Chain, what is her name? The wrestler? Chain something? Junk Chain. There it is.
It was. No, it's Dominican Junk Chain,
yes,
or whatever.
Dominican Junk Chain. The dancing wrestler.
Yeah.
Like, so
they're just too far down the cast list to be able to give them that kind of time, but they also have to be given something because it's a big cast. So, yeah, it's like ensemble shows can get over stuff, no question. And like Orange is the New Black, like, I haven't watched the new season of that, but my understanding of it is that they cut a lot of characters because they're in a new prison now. So, like, that's just the way things go with these. Like, the cast gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and eventually you have to cut it down. Mixed on the second season of GLOW, I had it pretty high on my year-end TV list last year. I think I'm just watching better shows this year. So I don't feel like it's going to be as high, but we'll revisit. What have I been watching? I watched the most recent entry in the Mission Impossible franchise, Fallout, the 6th one. This movie has been getting comparisons, and stay with me, Joe, to Fury Road in the context of it is an all-time action movie. It is the pinnacle of the form. It could not be any better if like stuntmen actually died. Like, that's how real the action feels.
I had never seen any Mission Impossible 2 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. So, like, I just started watching them all to get myself ready. And I thought they all got better. Everyone just got to be a better action movie. And so I'm not surprised if they kept that going, that this movie is getting, like, really, really good reviews, because I thought the last one, as far as like, I'm not going into expecting anything other than straight action for Mission mm-hmm. Impossible at this point. And they've been just upping it, you know, like the last movie starts off and this dude jumps onto a plane and is like, the plane's taking off. Like, that's how they start the movie. And so, you know, I'm not surprised that it's getting really good reviews.
So this one goes to 11.
I haven't seen the very first one. I have seen all the rest of them. I do think they got better up to this most recent one. The number 5 in the Mission Impossible series, it had like Tom Cruise diving into an underwater safe, like space age futuristic sets that just don't exist in the real world. The fourth one where he's climbing the Burj Khalifa in a sandstorm. Like that's just insane. It's insane stuff, and they sell it, and it looks real. It okay. might very well have been real. It was real. Okay, that's all fine.
Yeah.
In Fallout, there's an awesome car chase. Great. There's a skydiving sequence. There's a fist fight in a bathroom. There are many action sequences, but I just didn't think any of them, like, just totally blew my mind as far as the environment and the inventiveness of it. Like, there's a face mask switcheroo. Sure, those happen in Mission Impossible movies. They're fun, but I went into Fallout expecting it to just totally blow my mind, and it didn't. So I was a little let down. I prefer the fifth one and the fourth one. I'm outside of the critical consensus. Like a lot of the critics I follow are just raving about it. But I think I don't get as excited about like practical stunts as some of the people that I read and listen to. So it just didn't quite have that impact. Like it's a great car chase. It's about as good a car chase as you're going to have, but you gotta. There's one of those at least in every one of these previous movies. So you gotta show me something new. And Tom Cruise diving into an underwater safe is showing me something new.
That whole scene in that last one was dope.
It's a crazy sequence. They bring it's in the trailers that they bring the wife back to from the third one. I mean, this is kind of how I felt about the new Blade Runner in that. You're building that movie around a romance that happened in an earlier movie when that romance didn't necessarily work very well in the first place. So just any emotional oomph is just not going to work. And it's similar. Like, you don't think of Tom Cruise as a romantic lead or as really having any kind of sexual chemistry with an actress. Eyes Wide Shut was the last time he was able to get that across.
Yeah, all I want from Tom Cruise is for him to run around and shoot guns and
reasonable.
Do ridiculous stunts. Yeah.
Sprint and ride a motorcycle. Like,
the movie knows that he looks weird when he runs. There are some joke shots of him just in the background or darting through the frame in his very particular stride. It's absolutely worth watching, but... like the standard is just not quite there imagination wise.
Okay, so go in expecting a good movie or whatever, but not what people are saying. Not amazing, It's got like a 97 on Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah, I think it just depends how far thinking to yourself, like, holy shit, Tom Cruise is really doing that. How far that gets you. I think that goes really far with movie critics, who, in fairness, see a lot of garbage CGI effects. So I get it. Riley, what have you been watching?
So we went to the drive-in for the double feature of Teen Titans Go and Hotel Transylvania 3. We were there basically to see Hotel Transylvania. Had it played first, we probably would not have stuck around for Teen Titans Go.
Quick 5-second review of Hotel Transylvania.
It was the worst of the three by a long way, and the first two are only okay movies.
All right. Moving along.
So, luckily, Teen Titans was first. We knew almost nothing about it. We knew it was a cartoon that became a movie, and it was hilarious. So, the premise is the Teen Titans are Robin and Cyborg and other, like, C, D-level DC characters. I don't even know their names.
After basically, having seen the movie that features them.
Yeah, no, my God.
It was like 3 weeks ago, man.
All right, fair.
It's whatever. So it was these... And the point is, they're like C-level DC characters that you would not know if you did not know the show. Mm-hmm. And basically, the plot of the movie is that Robin is so jealous of all of the other DC heroes, and they all have movies, and Batman's got 100 movies, and they're making a movie about the Batmobile, and they're making a movie about Alfred, and he just really wants a movie about him, and his friends, the Teen Titans, and they do a lot of making fun of the DC universe. The villain in it looks kind of like Deadpool. I mean, it's just nonstop, like almost riffing on the whole comic book genre. And it's just, it was just hilarious. Like it was really made for a college stoner crowd.
It sounds so, like the Lego Movie in that.
I've got a question. So have you seen any of the actual show or the original Teen Titans? Okay.
So in the post-credits scene, it did tease like maybe the original Teen Titans was going to get a return. It was totally good enough that if I'm ever flipping through the channels and I see the actual show on, we will have no problem stopping and watching it.
I am surprised that like your kids don't watch it. I kind of thought that like every kid between like 7 and 10 was watching the show.
We almost only watched SpongeBob.
Okay.
That was my assumption too. Yeah.
Yeah. Brayden's not really into superheroes, but he thought it was hilarious. Kellen thought it was hilarious. It was a good movie.
I've seen actual episodes of Teen Titans Go, and I watched all of the original one. And if you like, it sounds like what Teen Titans Go is, just as a general thing. And you should definitely at least like throw it on for your kids a couple times.
Yeah.
So let me ask, is it anything like SpongeBob?
No, not really.
All right, because
it's like SpongeBob in that adults and college kids like it for a particular reason.
Okay, because I think SpongeBob is the worst thing on TV.
Oh, SpongeBob's not bad. SpongeBob's
it's terrible.
Totally watchable.
Okay, look, some old SpongeBob was good. I think it's good. I think it's random. God,
fucking SpongeBob hipster over here.
I have no idea what the fuck you guys are talking about.
Joe, what else have you been watching?
So I sat down with Laura earlier on this summer to pick a show out that we would watch together.
Go on.
And I was totally not looking forward to it. It's Love on Netflix. It is about one alcoholic played by Jillian Jacobs, and then her love interest, Paul Rust, who's certainly not a stoner in the show. But Paul Rust is this nerdy teacher type, neurotic, very much not in the league of Jillian Jacobs' character by the name of Mickey, who's supposed to be cool, edgy, living in L.A., producer on a satellite radio show. And in the whole show is basically following the development of their friendship and eventually the love interest that, you know, obviously sparks early on. And it turned out to be a pretty good show. I've enjoyed it. I think it's, what, 3 seasons long now? We made it through all 3 seasons this summer.
It's over, right?
You know, I honestly have no idea if it's done or over with. Okay. I wouldn't be surprised after this if they both are way too busy for other things now, but you know, it's a Judd Apatow show.
Does it feel like it?
Yes, absolutely does. Yes.
Okay.
If you're a fan of him, I think this is kind of right up your alley. He puts his daughter in it.
She's good and Knocked Up.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I'm seeing her in more and more stuff.
She's excellent.
It's almost if you have a super producer dad and an actress mom, you can get roles in movies.
Right, exactly. She is fantastic in it. And it took me a minute to click on why her face was recognizable. But then you think back to Knocked Up and the lines that she threw out there. But yeah, Paul Rust, Jillian Jacobs, they definitely kind of, you enjoy watching them. And you can't really figure out who's crazier between the two. I enjoyed it. I would recommend it. It's fun to watch, if not totally frustrating, watching people make really horrible decisions.
All right. JR, what else you got?
Number 2 for me would be DuckTales.
Okay.
Jesus.
So I started watching it because it's a DuckTales reboot. Let me check it out. I watched DuckTales when I was growing up. And it's actually pretty good. I don't really remember the original DuckTales as much as other TV shows I watched when I was young, as I say as a 26-year-old.
Sure.
But this one, I mean, they've only got 15 episodes, and you can already, you know, one of the things they're doing is the Huey, Dewey, and Louie are, like, working. They're working with Uncle Scrooge to do all their adventures or whatever, and, like on the side while they're doing these adventures, they're also trying to figure out what happened to their mom. So that they've got this whole side story for them, while also Scrooge has his thing of these boys are helping them become essentially a sack of shit. But there's been like in the 15 episodes, there's been a decent amount of like character growth, you know, not like Avatar the Last Airbender level
sure.
of character growth, but you know, Disney XD.
You can differentiate amount of, between like, the three like,
yeah.
ducks.
You know the difference between them, and you can tell the difference between when they got dropped off to live with them in the first episode versus like now in the 15th episode. You know, one guy's like gotten over his fear of whatever because of how he's been treated and all this stuff. And then they also just throw in every once in a while like random old things. Like on one episode, they were watching Darkwing Duck. But it's like they're watching Darkwing Duck, and Darkwing Duck has been doing his show since the original Darkwing Duck. So he's like old on the TV show and is like barely able to do his stunts anymore. And like, you know, like he's like jumping off of buildings and like hitting the ground and like not rolling like he should. And, you know, like he gets up and he like he's like limping off and he's like, oh. He looks at the camera. He's like, oh, keep rolling. Like, keep the camera rolling. We got to do this. It's like little things like that. They like throw in all these like references to, you know, Donald Duck and, you know, all the old shows that had to do with ducks and stuff like that, which is, you know, I thought was fun. But it's just been it only comes on, you know, they didn't drop it, or I only wait once a week to watch a 30-minute show in the morning while I'm cooking breakfast on a Saturday. And it's been
it's got some names doing the voices. I mean, Bobby Moynihan and David Tennant is Scrooge McDuck. But, I mean, there's some names doing the voices on it.
Yeah, I mean,
like, soaked up some stuff through the internet that, like, it's solid. Like, it gets serious,
yeah.
like, serious critical attention in its own way.
Yeah.
I have a quick question about, like, the ecological realism of the show. Ducks are well-known rapists. Does that come into play in the show at all?
Yes.
Okay, wow. All right.
Yeah.
I was wrong to assume the answer to that.
Yeah, they definitely talk about how they have, like, corkscrew dicks. And
DuckTales After Dark.
That does right, not come up, so
good for them.
You don't have to worry about that if you're watching with your kids.
They gotta know how nature works, I think. Anyways...
Last thing I want to say about it after that whole thing, anybody with a kid, I would say, like, if your kids watch cartoons, throw this on for them. They'll like it, and they'll watch it.
Riley,
you know,
what do you
got? That's a plus for everyone with kids.
Okay, so I've been watching a lot of YouTube, specifically two different channels.
InfoWars.
Nope, sorry, Joe. One of them I'll just gloss over. I watched a couple of the Game Changer accounts for the Star Wars Galaxy of Heroes app.
Oh, dear.
Because that's the only game that I play. And lots of strategy tips on there.
Sure.
But the other one I've been watching, if you're Facebook friends with me, you've seen a lot of information about youth baseball recently.
Yes.
Because I have to create a new travel team for Braden's season next year. So I follow Driveline on Twitter. Driveline is a baseball academy out in Washington. Real research heavy. Well, they have a YouTube page where they do some drills. They also have a series of live at bats where they just have a pitcher pitching. The camera is from the pitcher's POV. So it's basically like you see in the majors, only instead of being 300 feet away and at an angle, you're all up into it, and you're seeing the break of the ball and everything. Well, but they also edit the shit out of it. And self-described, come for the dank-ass memes. it's hilarious the way they cut the videos together to, like, clown on their hitters who can't hit or, you know, crushing home runs off of them, because they have all of these at-bats. They're in a batting cage, but they're using the HitTrax technology where it will, you know, kind of like a golf simulator where it tells you where the ball goes and everything. But they have that for baseball too. So they'll, like, you know, they'll be up there, they'll hit it, and they say, oh, that's a ground out. or, you know, if somebody hits a home run, they'll like just recut it with like a bunch of Taylor Swift songs onto it, and like have the pitcher crying and a bunch of crying Jordan memes, whole bunch. It's just funny shit. And there's a ton of them, and there's some pro players on it and some kind of middling pro players on it and college players.
Okay. So, I was hearing this as like small children doing this.
Oh no, these are adults.
Okay.
So
that makes me feel
so
better
that,
about this channel.
That makes it no, I actually feel worse.
I was
about
really
this
looking forward to it.
I was looking, yeah. That's what I was looking forward to as well. Like a grown ass man hitting a home run off of like a 10-year-old. Yeah.
They do have a high school episode, but I think that's as low as they go. Trevor Bauer, who's going to win the Cy Young in the AL this year, is like their big, you know, celebrity guy that, you know, all of the main baseball facilities have their one guy that they hang their hat on. He's their big guy for pitching that they hang their hat on. And he's in several of the episodes, and he's like openly, and they all openly talk shit to each other as they're doing it. And it's just really cut together well. And baseball players are weird. They're kind of their own type of person more so than any other sport to me.
Oh, they're such dirtbags.
They're weird dudes.
Oh,
but
yeah.
It makes for funny 8-minute episodes.
What's the name of this channel?
Driveline. Yeah, you probably would not be interested unless you care anything about baseball. Like
one
I said that John
I still want to watch some ridiculous stuff.
Oh, yeah. There's some. Yes. Yeah, stay for the dank ass memes. They say.
And like if you have a daughter, like baseball players are the ones you want them to stay away from in college. Baseball players are the worst.
Yeah, the episodes are mostly guys who, like, there's a couple guys that are in almost every one that play for the Southern Illinois Miners. It's like a Frontier League team. Mm-hmm. That have gone out to Seattle to train. And there's a few guys that are like AAA guys. There's a few major leaguers that are both pitching and hitting. But it's just, I enjoy it. You would hate it because, you know, sure, you love baseball so much.
I'm sure
I think Shane would dig it.
There's like a reasonable base hit or something that I have to get through.
More strikeouts and more, you know, ground outs and flyouts, but that's what baseball is. You know, it's a game of failure.
Woof. I saw a movie today called Leave No Trace from Deborah Granick, who we would all know from her previous feature film, Winter's Bone. Winter's Bone is a great movie, arguably an all-timer. Been 8 years since she made a fucking movie, which is absurd. Winter's Bone is, like, brilliant directing, and Leave No Trace is her 8 years later follow-up. And it's not like she was struggling to come up with an idea or anything. She just couldn't find financing to get movies made. This is absurd. Hopefully this is something that's going to change as Hollywood changes over the last like year and a half, 2 years, and going forward in the future, that here nor there. The point is, Leave No Trace is another great movie, as you would expect from the director of Winter's Bone. Just as Jennifer Lawrence broke out in that movie, I would suspect that the female lead in Leave No Trace, whose name I don't have handy, is also going to like build a career off of this role. It is about Ben Foster, who is an Iraq War veteran, or a War on Terror veteran. It's unclear exactly where he fought, but he has pretty bad PTSD, and he is self-medicating by completely retreating from society, and he has his teenage daughter with him. And the movie starts with them, like, secret camping in a Oregon state park, and you see how they live. And eventually they get busted by park authorities and are pushed back into society. The teenage daughter is increasingly not willing to live this way. Like, they don't have a bad life, but it's just one very specific brand of lifestyle that she is less and less interested in. And father and daughter clash in a benign way over the course of the movie. And Deborah Granick, like, my favorite scene from Winter's Bone, like a family of bluegrass, like a bluegrass band that was also like several generations of an Ozark family, sitting in their living room playing music. And there are similar scenes where Granick just has such love and affection for like rustic types who have who can work with their hands and who can take care of themselves in nature, and you know, who just have a lot of secret knowledge that is increasingly leaving and leaving and leaving the modern world. And it's a really compelling movie. Leave No Trace. Pretty good stuff.
This is 100% an art cinema, art theater
it
movie.
It very much is, yes.
Like, yeah, okay.
Ben Foster sounds like he's a great pick for this. I've been a fan of him for a few years now. I think the first thing I saw him in was it was a miniseries a few years back. What was it? The Hatfield and the McCoys.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds like his jam.
And he was fantastic in it. And so I've been a big fan of his for a while. And this is just hearing you talk about it sounds like something that I'm definitely going to get on the list.
Yeah. I think he's somewhat typecast as a crazy person, like judo chopping and backflip kicking people in Alpha Dog, or his crazy cowboy character in 310 to Yuma, like those kind of characters. He's completely the opposite in Leave No Trace. He's in no way like that. He never raises his voice, but it's apparent that he's a very serious individual while also having a lot of problems. It's multifaceted, and I think it's easy to go crazy in movies and be big, and this is the opposite of that. It's reasonable that he'll receive some end of year award stuff if this movie has enough pull. I don't know, we'll see.
Does Leave No Trace have any of that Ruby Ridge element to it? Obviously,
no,
Ruby Ridge being a real thing. Okay.
Not at all. There's no militia type backwoods. It's not that kind of movie. My last thing that I've been watching is Only the Brave, which stars Josh Brolin and the fucking kid from Whiplash, whose name is escaping me right now, and Taylor Kitsch from Friday Night Lights. It's a movie about wildfire firefighters, and I had something of low expectations when I fired it up. It really came and went in theaters, but as far as the kind of movies that are about men in crisis doing a job together, this is about as good as that movie can possibly be. I really love this film. It's really affecting. It's about a true story that I didn't know. So it both felt real and surprised me as it went along. And I think it helps to not know the real story of this particular wildfire. Competence porn. It's not hyper masculine. These guys are hugging on each other and kissing each other on the forehead and telling them they love each other while not emasculating themselves in any way. They're both affectionate to their comrades while also clearly being competent, strong men. And I think that was the extra thing that boosted this movie into the A range for me.
Sounds like a bunch of hippie Hollywood bullshit.
They're fucking roughneck firefighters in Arizona. So, if anybody earned the right to fuck each other in the desert wilderness, great. It's that they fucking took a trench and halted a fire that was raging a half an hour earlier.
Quick question. And I have a hard time taking Jeff Bridges serious. I don't really buy him. Is he going to ruin this for me?
I do buy him. So I buy him as a fire chief who has a country western band, who cares about his men and who gives him good advice. So yeah, I buy him. But then I bought him in everything. He's Jeff Bridges.
Man, that's a big leap
for
me.
Jeff Bridges type.
Yeah, he's the dude.
That's fair, but
I can't let go of that.
The dude is not a leader of men.
I know, that's the problem.
The dude abides, Joe.
JR, what's your last thing?
My last thing is American Dad. It's been my I'm doing something, I'll throw it on in the background.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not super paying attention. I was expecting it to be terrible because I absolutely hate Family Guy. I think this is 1,000 times better, in my opinion.
I 100% agree with you. 100%.
Yeah. Like, this is actually, I think it's a good show. Like, I've really been enjoying it. The whole, like, thing with Steve being, like, this gobbly R&B singer every time they have him singing. He's like, straight up Keith Sweat. That's who he is.
Yeah,
like,
he's Keith Sweat. Exactly. That's exactly right.
Yeah. Those like, one-off things where, you know, like, they have a whole episode. They have a whole six-minute song where he's doing a Trapped in the Closet. It's done so well that I had to show my family. Like, you guys are going to think this is amazing. This little white kid, like, supposedly singing like a perfect 90s R&B singer. But just as a general, you can tell that Obama became president during the show. Like, they do a good job of, you know, like, the whole first, like, three or four seasons or whatever, Bush was in there, and so they were just absolutely trashing Republicans and the whole super patriotic realm of everything, and then Obama comes in, and then they start trashing the left as well, because obviously, you know, need to keep it real, but it's still all about how terrible of a dad, whatever his name is, Stan, and how he's just, like, so patriotic that it's, like, ridiculous, and, you know, he's so pro-American and all this crap. I mean, this is, like, a really good show that I would recommend for anyone. I don't know if anybody would, you should watch it, but definitely, like, throw on episodes every once in a while at least.
I think, like, that delineation between, like, the Bush years and the Obama years, I think the show gets so much better once they move behind, like, the neocon Patriot Act waterboarding stuff. It becomes less topical, and it gives more room to, like, make the alien character the star of the show, where just anything can happen.
I've just been putting it off for, what, 13 years now, because
it's been on there for a long
time. Thought it was going to be Family Guy. Yeah, I thought it was going to be Family Guy, and it's
miles better.
Well, I mean, I'm going to talk about a documentary, and it is called The Brothers in Blood, The Lions of Sabby Sand. This is probably my favorite thing that I watched in the last 6 to 10, 12 months. Essentially, it is a documentary about a coalition of lions. And essentially, this coalition of six lions, they're all brothers because they all came from the same pride. This documentary follows them around, and it essentially documents their rise to power in this area in South Africa. And it is absolutely brutal. They become known as the Mapoho Lions, and the show doesn't pull any punches. It's violent. It is gut-wrenching at times. It was made in 2015 and only takes an hour. It's only an hour long, but it is so well worth it.
So, two things. There's, like, the Disney brand of these nature documentaries where you have, like, John C. Reilly voicing a bunch of bears, and it, like, applies, like, a narrative arc to these wild animals. Like, they're trying to get from one place to another, or, I don't know, a mom loses its baby, but it gets pregnant again and finds another baby, whatever. But there's always something like a happy ending. This seems far away from that.
There's a scene in here that when the Mapohos are basically posturing and trying to get one of the lionesses to mate with them, she has to pick which lion to mate with. Well, she doesn't pick, and so they tear her apart.
Okay, so no. James Franco isn't doing the voice work, is what you're saying.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
That leads nicely into my second question. Like, we talked about ducks and their psychopathic behavior. Psychopathic not being the right word. They are animals, but, you know, like lions. Let's say one of these male lions takes over a new pride. Day one, kill all the babies.
That's done several times.
Okay, great. Okay, and so we're sticking with that.
It is documented on more than one occasion, and it's more brutal than you can imagine.
I believe you. Like, the animal protagonist of a Disney nature documentary isn't committing genocide, or the lion equivalent.
Yeah. They're not interested in being stuck by
her. Tina Fey's bouncy voice isn't putting thoughts in this animal's head as it's ripping a cute baby lion cub to shreds.
Yes, it blew me away. Like, I understand that they're wild animals, but and that's part of the appeal to this documentary, is that these Mapojos, this group of six, it's like they took things to a whole different level.
It's like they escalated animal cruelty.
Yes. And that's what the documentary, the experts on the show were like, we were in the right place at the right time to see this, because the amount of land that they covered, the approach that they had with other lions, he's like, this is not normal.
Like, just the act of teaming up sounds strange with what little we know about lions.
Yes, because coalitions are not known to be six lions deep. You've got to watch this thing, because it blew me away.
It kind of sounds like it might have been financed by, like, poachers who are trying to turn people against lions so they can freely skin them and use their pelts.
Yeah, and it's funny you even bring that up, because one of the zoologists or the experts in the movie, they were like, you really wanted to hate these guys. You know, talking about the lions, he's like, but they just became so larger than everything around them that, you know, they were the main show in town. They kind of just like, hey, what are these guys going to do next?
Well, speaking of sociopathic behavior, we're going to jump into our last topic of The Americans, which wrapped up its final season in May. Joe, JR, you don't have to stick around if you haven't seen it. If you might watch it at some point, because I'm sure
Ryan
and I will be spoiling it.
Oh, it's going to be spoilery.
Yeah, so I'm going to head out.
Okay.
I want to give my sign-off that everyone should go see 2001 A Space Odyssey when they drop it in the 70mm IMAX theaters in September. So...
All of our listeners in Montana are cursing you right now. Like, how the fuck are we going to get to a theater showing 2000?
But I got one like 5 minutes from me, and you probably got like a 30.
Sorry, Big Sky Country. We know you guys are loyal patrons, but
I'm just trying to figure out how long it's going to take to get the weed stank out of the theater.
Thank you for joining me tonight, JR and Joe.
Thanks, John.
Peace out, fellas.
So, The Americans. This is arguably the saddest show on television, or for the period of time that it was on television. And that is not something that let up in the final season. I think Phillip's face has never been longer in this final season. We got a really nice slow pan shot on... just him about as sad as he has ever been, as he realizes that he has to spy on his wife. The backstory on the Americans is that they are deep cover Soviet spies in the 80s, as the in the last decade of the Soviet Union's existence. And by the final season, their daughter has been recruited. Philip, the husband, is out. Elizabeth, the wife, is as hardcore as she's ever been, and in the last 10 episodes, their lives unravel. I blasted this out in like 3 or 4 days. It's fucking tough. It is tough show.
I did the last two seasons in a week.
And the fifth season is all about like getting Philip to quit. And it's been...
Yes.
It's not like
hard season.
He wasn't doing sunshine and lollipops in the first four seasons. Like, the fifth season fucking pushes him. Yeah, that sounds punishing. I've been putting off the second season of Handmaid's Tale because it's such an unpleasant show, as great as it is. The Americans is close to it.
I would say for sure on The Americans, season one, I was super excited about Cold War, espionage, spies, totally in my wheelhouse. I was like, oh, this show's going to be awesome. I enjoyed it, but it was your typical season one of a series that knew it had some legs. It was a lot of world building.
Yeah, yeah.
Throughout, what, did they, six seasons, was it?
Yeah, six seasons.
Throughout six seasons, I have never been happier that I invested in a show.
Yeah.
They paid it off so well. Philip and Stan, the FBI neighbor of the spies, their bromance was the most authentic TV friendship, in just the way that it had to come to pass, that you knew for six seasons that they were going to be outed at some point.
Yeah.
And as it happened, it was just heartbreaking for both of them.
Did that final scene, like in the parking garage, I haven't read anything about it, like about the final season. I haven't read any reviews or like behind the scenes stuff. I kind of thought that last confrontation went on a little bit too long.
You thought
like they started repeating themselves. Am I crazy?
I was crying, so I don't remember if thinking that it was too long. It was, to me, it earned every minute of it, from their relationship for five seasons. That moment earned an episode.
Yeah, that's fair. That's just me nitpicking, I think. That's interesting that you bring it up. It's never a show that made me cry, just because the sadness in it is so bone deep, and they're bad people. They're full stop bad people. It's pretty amazing that the show made, I lost track of Walter White in the third or the fourth season, and arguably that was too long, that I was able to not just root for their downfall really at any point during the series. Is yeah. Really impressive. When you watch all those final season episodes so close together, you start to realize a pattern in the first four or five, okay, Elizabeth is going to murder an innocent person and the episode's going to end. And that's more or less how the first four or five went. Just the body count is so high and she's so blinded. And she's she's anti the flow of history, but still, you just can't fully hate her. She's a cult member who's finally breaking out, and the fucking irony of it is that now she's stuck there forever.
Right. Well, in that she never does break out. Not only is she stuck there forever, she is still Captain Soviet. She just happened to be a part of a scheme to betray her own people. And she felt that that was a betrayal. And she felt a deeper loyalty to Gorbachev as the head of the party than her syndicate that was the KGB that was giving her orders.
I think in 3 years, she kills herself at the end of the series. She, at the end, made a calculation that even though she doesn't want Gorbachev, even her greatest fear is the Soviet Union getting closer to America culturally and becoming America, and they forget their history, blah, blah, blah. The people that she goes against feels the exact same way, but they just have a different interpretation of how one gets to that place.
Yeah.
But she spent the last 20 years doing the exact same thing, and she's going to realize it, especially once the Soviet Union collapses, and it really was all for nothing then. She's been making these calculations. How many bystanders did she kill? And Philip, too. He's just had more time to, dwell on it.
And yeah, he's been, you've been waiting for him to defect since season two.
Yeah. Yes, and it's always been about the Soviet Union.
He just loves her.
Yeah.
Yes, he loves her more than anything else.
I need to help her, or she'll get killed, or she'll leave, or whatever else. And just eventually that's too much for him.
The conversation she has with the daughter about, you know, first lying about using sex for information, and then finally, you know, after she's, you know, sleep deprived and stressed out, it's like, you know what? It's just sex. It doesn't fucking matter.
Yeah.
I do it. Your dad does it. Grow up. That, I mean, again, cold, heartbreaking. Yeah. Like, you're talking to your 18-year-old daughter.
The series for so long has been, like, hanging on to these moments where they tell their, well, they never tell Henry anything, but Paige, like, just telling her little pieces and pieces, and to just throw out so much in, like, one big burst. It's fucking devastating. It's absolutely devastating. And having watched it so close to the fifth season, too, there are so many... Oh my God, I'm just fucking raving at this point. Like, there are so many scenes in The Americans that just play out as two characters looking at something, or one character looking at something. And there's Philip and Elizabeth looking at the priest's diary when he's talking about Paige. There's, like, Stan searching around their house for stuff. Like, the
putting
biggest
pieces
scenes,
together.
Yeah, the biggest scenes in the show are silent. Like, if I had to put together, just rattle off the top of my head, scenes that just loom the largest for The Americans, there's Philip pulling Elizabeth's tooth, and it's like 3 minutes of them just staring at each other while he is wrenching, like, a metaphorical abscess out of her mouth. Or, like, folding up the dead woman in the suitcase, where it's just pure procedure. This is how you would do something like that. No one says anything. Or at the very end, where
are we going to stuff her in the trunk of the car? Well, you know, how about we just cut her head and her feet off, and then light her on fire so that there's nothing to identify her from?
Yeah.
It's like, we'll just, because it's easier to transport a head and some hands than it is a whole body.
Yeah. And they don't talk about it, but it's all in their face.
Yeah. It's all like, oh, I made eye contact with you. I looked over at the axe.
Yeah,
we gave each other the head nod. It was like they were going to, you know, run a pickoff move. Back to baseball for you, John.
God damn. I didn't love it until, like, the third or fourth. It's a hard show to love. I feel like love is too strong. It was like an obligation for the first couple seasons, and then it just keeps reeling you in. And at a certain point after the fifth season, I, like, had an aborted attempt to go through the whole series again, and it was so much more powerful the second time through. I only got, like, 5 or so episodes into it before I just lost track.
Well, speaking of trying to go a second time through, I had almost forgotten about the teenage girl that Philip had used as a source, because her dad was in the CIA, that he was the cool stoner friend. And Elizabeth made him fuck her.
Yeah, bringing that back.
Oh.
She was like in her early 20s at that point, at least.
Yeah,
like,
but to Philip, she was still a child.
Yes, absolutely. Like, she's Paige's age. He's known her for, you know, 6 or 7 years. That was like a constant fear in the back of my head in that third season when that character was first introduced, that, Jesus Christ, he's going to have sex with her at some point. It's fucking horrifying. And it would not have been difficult in, like, the language of the show for him to get that for him to do that.
In the way that he did that, to where he ended up warning her to, you know, keep her safe, the show very well could have had him and Elizabeth.
It's so easy
come to their own final moment between the two of them.
It's so easy to imagine it going horribly wrong for her. thankfully they didn't go that way, but it's not like they slow rolled it or softballed it or whatever. Like, it was still awful. It was still awful.
Mm-hmm.
This is a great show, and it makes you feel like fucking garbage.
Specifically in terms of, I can't think of a single series finale better than this series finale. As a series finale, it wrapped things up, which people want. It left slivers of hope in that Paige walked away, stayed home. You know that Stan is going to protect her. If need be. I think she's going to be an American person. She's just going to realize the horrible things that she's done. She's going to stay with Henry, and they're going to adjust. And Stan will be there for them.
Imagining it as cheerful as that. I think she just kind of disappears. Like, she has a general sense of how to live underground now. Maybe change her identity. I don't know. Maybe that was communicated to her. Maybe she has access to that kind of stuff. I don't think that she... Well, let's see. I don't know. It's tough.
I don't think she was staying because she didn't want to go to Russia. She was staying because she wanted to be with Henry.
I think it was about getting away from her parents. I hope that's what it was. Thinking about the show and not having rewatched in a long time, I am moderately skeptical of how she bought into it, the whole thing.
I can see that.
Like, maybe she got into it easier than the show should have allowed her to.
Perhaps her sudden devotion to Christ and her church allowed her to be more easily brainwashed by her parents, in that her brain was already brainwashed once.
That being said, I certainly bought, like, all the work that Claudia and her mom did in, like, ingratiating her to Soviet culture and Soviet history. Like, all that made sense to me. I thought that was exceptionally well done. Yeah, like, she was never gonna go along with the honeypot stuff, and I think the show did really well in not pushing her down that route. And it, to say nothing of the violence. Although the show, again, there did a great job. Like, it sensed that she might go down that way. Like, it's fun and thrilling to dole violence out, and then her own father has to beat the shit out of her.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's like, oh, you think you're tough? You've been sparring with your mom. Well, let's spar with me for a minute.
I owe it a rewatch, just because I was pretty lukewarm on it for a while, but I bet it would knock me the fuck out now. Like, I think it had as good a sense of its characters as any of the best dramas, like the best written dramas, like The Sopranos and Mad Men in particular. I don't think it fucked its ending up like Breaking Bad did. I think it's an all-timer. I think it's an all-time show. I think it was probably the technically critical consensus best show on TV over the last, like, 2 or 3 years. Mm-hmm. I don't know what's behind it. I don't know what that show is now. Like, maybe the golden age is, like, slowing down a little bit.
I was going to say, is it the end of the golden age?
I don't think it's the end, but I don't think there's, like, a successor to the Americans, like, waiting in the wings. Like, Game of Thrones is pop TV now. And
so what are your final thoughts on Philip's last words to Stan? I think Renee may be one of us, but I don't know.
As much as
like,
I believe,
I was surprised Stan didn't shoot himself in the face right then.
No shit. Like, as much as I believe their relationship and their affection for each other as friends, that's a terrible thing to say to someone as the last time you're ever going to see them.
And Stan, you know, in the wrap up, Stan's clearly still thinking about that comment.
I think the show could maybe have done a better job making it less obvious. Just, like, the ham-fist. If she is a spy, I don't think she's that good. Like, the ham-fisted way she brought up, maybe I can be an FBI agent. Like, she wouldn't know, like, there's an age cutoff for agents. And like that level of naivety speaks to her not being a spy, but she has to be, because it doesn't make sense for the show to give her so much screen time.
I loved how he responded to that, though. He was like, oh, that would be great, sweetie, but gosh darn it, there's an age cutoff. You're too old.
It's impossible to imagine her not being a spy. I'm surprised that they let that go. Like, they didn't put their finger on the scale. To the point where I'm wondering, like, what that means in the context of the show. Like, what's the thematic point of that? Like, it's just never going to end for Stan. He's always going to have the suspicion, I guess, but...
Yeah, of living the American dream, just like their, you know, the FBI informant had given him as he was piecing it all together. He kept on remembering, she's beautiful, he's the lucky guy, they're two regular people living the American dream.
I need to go back and rewatch it. There's just a lot of good TV to get caught up on. Yeah, if you're still listening... The Americans, all of it is on Amazon Prime, and like it's a show that's gonna last. Like, it's a show that's gonna stick around and like be recognized as one of the great shows of the period. What have you been watching? Another one of the books. A lot of stuff to talk about. A lot of recommendations. We went from DuckTales to The Americans. I think we've hit the whole swath of entertainment.
Yeah. Follow us. even. Some inside baseball YouTube
formats, media. I mean, we will not be held down at the Mediocre Movie Club, and you can further find out what we've been watching at mediocremovie.club. You can follow us on Facebook at Mediocre Movie Club and on Twitter at Mediocre Movie Cult. We just posted a review. We're talking this week about Free Fire. It's a shootout in a warehouse, 90 minutes. Brie Larson, Charlotte Copley. That's pretty much the movie. Lane kicked off our discussion with a review. He liked that movie a whole lot more than I did. I thought it was boring as shit, and I didn't like any of those people, and I wish that they had got shot in the face about an hour earlier than they did. Here nor there, it's something of a fun movie, I suppose. We got some Game of Thrones greatest hits coming up here shortly. We're going to record that next week for your listening pleasure, because who doesn't love Game of Thrones? We're going to remember when that was a solidly great series. Just not the case.
We're gonna have power rankings, and Joe even forgot to sign up for episodes, so he maybe did. No Joe's bold take.
Whether that makes you want to listen more or less, we'll leave up to you. I mean, it's a total coin flip, but it'll be fun. That'll be fun to talk about. Thank you for joining me tonight, Riley.
No problem, John. I as soon as I was done with The Americans, I think I maybe waited 48 hours before I said, hey, have you finished watching this yet? We need to talk about it.
There's a lot to talk about, no question.
Yeah.
We hope you check it out, and we also hope that you have a good night.